This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's a snowy Monday up and down the East Coast. And for all that we here on the Cape and Islands got a foot or so, we certainly weren't the hardest hit. The National Weather Service is reporting between 17 and 18 inches of snow in Washington, D.C., and says that may actually be an underestimate. So how does a blizzard in D.C. fit in with the fact that we're coming off the hottest year on record? And how do we best teach our students to understand and address complicated science issues like climate change? Later this hour, a discussion of science standards and teaching practices. First, the climate issue. Gavin Schmidt is a climatologist, climate modeler, and director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. He's also a climate communicator par excellence. He co-founded the award-winning Real Climate blog. And in 2011, he was awarded the inaugural AGU Climate Communication Prize and named the Earth Sky Science Communicator of the Year. Gavin Schmidt, welcome to Living Lab.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you're in New York City, correct?
I am, yeah.
So how did you make out this weekend? You guys were supposed to get slammed with both the snow and some pretty strong storm surge and coastal flooding.
So I was actually on the Jersey Shore this weekend, and indeed there was a lot of flooding, but they seem to have coped well with it where we were. Coming back into the city this weekend, it's clear that the city itself has had its work cut out for it in clearing off, you know, almost 2 feet of snow from the roads. If you were parked on the streets on Friday, well, you're still going to be parked next week, I think.
May not be digging out for a while. I mean,
it's going to take a job.
With any large storm at this point, the question seems to come up, is this climate change? So how do you address that question, and how do you or do you make a distinction between climate and weather?
So there really is a distinction. You know, New York City has had big storms before, and it will have them again. I mean, there's interesting science to be done on how changes in the global mean temperature impacts local weather statistics, but that's very much at the cutting edge of weather science is right now. In terms of global warming, we're looking far more at the long-term trends. You're looking at the fact that 2015 was a record warm year, which came on top of 2014, which is also a record warm year. And in fact, that 15 of the last of the top 16 years of war occurred in this century. Those are long-term trends, and it turns out that those are much easier for us to attribute, for us to find the cause and effect than, you know, individual weather events. So for some weather events, we can do a pretty good job. If you heat waves, intense rainfall, those have both been linked very clearly to the changes that are ongoing in the climate.
So how does snowfall fit into our understanding of climate change? Should we expect to see, I mean, you know, record warm year both last year and the year before, and yet the winter of 2015 here in New England was incredibly snowy, and now we've got this, right? And some people worried that we're about to see a repeat of last year. How does that fit in?
So if you look year by year, you can have these very extreme kind of bi-coastal results. You know, so last winter was very, very warm on the West Coast, very, very cold on the East Coast. But if you remember back to 2010, 2011, that was the opposite. It was very, very warm on the East and cold in the West. One of those things are part of the natural variability, and I think, you know, perhaps we don't actually pay as much attention to weather as perhaps we should, or perhaps we used to in the past. But weather, particularly in the wintertime, is very variable. And only some of those things can be blamed on greenhouse gases or El Nino or some of the things. Some of it is just part of the chaotic dynamics of the weather system itself.
Now let's talk about 2015's heat. How much of the record-breaking heat, and we should say that 2015 was not only the hottest year on record, it broke the record by the largest margin on record. So it was really the hottest year on record. How much of that is climate change? How much of that is El Nino? And how much of that is just random chance?
So people have worked on all three of those questions. So our analysis suggests that we would have had a record warm year even without the El Nino effect. El Nino, particularly towards the end of last year, has given us a bit of an assist. It will actually keep 2016 warmer than we would otherwise think. And so 2016 may actually be another record year. Going back to, you know, what's going on with these natural cycles and things, we've been looking at these trends now for more than 30 years. The first time that NASA started talking about global warming as a public issue was in 1988. 1988, at the time, was a record year. Now it's only the 23rd warmest year. Right? Wow. So we've had another 22 years warmer than that over the last 30 years. So these are trends. We have looked at all the different things that could be causing it. We've been looking at volcanoes, the sun, deforestation, air pollution, natural ocean cycles. Each of those things has a particular fingerprint in the data. It has a fingerprint in the pattern of warming, in what happens in the ocean, what happens in the atmosphere. And when we look at those fingerprints, the only thing that's really dominating the trends that we see is the rise in greenhouse gases. And predominant among those is carbon dioxide, and that's rising because of the amount of fossil fuel that we're burning, natural gas, coal, and oil.
The message that you've been conveying for the past several minutes here, I mean, that weather is not the same as climate, that we can't always attribute any one storm to climate change, but that we are seeing long-term changes. I mean, this is nuanced. This is complicated. How do you convey that to the public, especially in a media landscape where, you know, the norm is a 10-second soundbite, or you may have a minute or two of somebody's attention?
You're absolutely right. It's a huge challenge. This is a complex situation, and I don't think we do the subject any favors by trying to hide that complexity. And in fact, I think we need to embrace that complexity. Climate change is related to other environmental issues. It's related to air quality. It's related to energy policy. All of those things actually are connected. And it's hard. But one of the things that buoys me up a little bit is that people know that. When you ask people, what do you think about climate change? What do you think about global warming? What do you think about the weather? The question that gets the most positive responses is, do you think you need to know more? And something like 80% of people say they think that they need to know more, but they find that it's very hard to do that, that they don't know where to go to find trusted sources or trustable sources on the topic. And as you're very well aware, there's a lot of media pollution on this issue where we have people actually trying to confuse people and trying to make it sound more complicated than it is. So people know that you're not getting the essence of this topic in the soundbite or in the headline, and they want to know more. So I think our challenge as scientists or public communicators or educators is really helping people to investigate for themselves, find trustable sources, and educate themselves on topics that are impacting their daily life.
Well, to that last point that you made, I mean, if we're talking about students and what they're being taught in school, there is no way that we can teach kids everything they need to know about climate science or any scientific field, because of course the state of the field is always changing. So in your mind, as a scientist and a communicator on this issue, what is it really important that we teach our students about science in general and climate science specifically?
Well, I mean, this is a cliche, but you have to teach people how to be critical consumers of media and information. And to be savvy enough to dig into things for themselves. A lot of time we don't have time to, really look into a topic. And so we skim the headlines, we skim our Twitter feed or our Facebook friends, and we say, okay, well, that sounds interesting, but, I'll do it later, and you never do. At school and at university, we have, I think, slightly more scope to help people say, stop, okay, that's an interesting statement. Is it true? Where does it come from? Who are the sources behind it? You know, what was the statistical power of that study? To ask questions like, is that supported by other evidence, or is it a random, kind of contrarian finding that only got a headline because it's actually the opposite of what everybody thinks? To understand, I think, a little bit about the media landscape or the social media landscape that that children and young adults find themselves in, and to drill down into where information with some heft can be found, as opposed to the fluff that everybody sees. So I think, it has to be that kind of contrast. You know, nobody is saying don't pay attention to the headlines, don't use your Facebook feed, don't use social media. That would be silly. But when you see these things and when you see things that intrigue you, give people the tools so that they can dive in, find the papers, find the data, find the consilience of evidence that supports one thing or another. And if maybe if it's really it really is an ambiguous issue, to understand that and be okay with the fact that some things are not known perfectly.
That's Gavin Schmidt, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York and co-founder of the blog Real Climate. Gavin, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
His message, slow down, think critically, and understand the media. We'll see if that jives with other thoughts on what we need to be teaching students in science in our schools. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The space race inspired a generation of students interested in science. Today, the issues facing aspiring scientists are no less momentous. For that matter, though, science issues touch all of us at this point. From climate change, as we just heard, and renewable energy, to genetically modified organisms, genetic testing, cutting-edge medical treatments, science is all around us. When it comes to preparing students to tackle these issues as both citizens and possibly as scientists, there's research about the best way to teach and learn science. There are also standards to meet and tests to take, and all of it seems to change at a bewildering pace. So today we're breaking it down. Brian Reiser is professor of learning sciences in the School of Education and Social Policy at Northwestern University. He helped develop the next generation science standards and guidelines for assessments to go along with those standards. Michael DeSpezio is an author, TV host, and speaker specializing in science and science education. He's written a number of textbooks and developed curricula to put standards into action in the classroom. Brian and Michael, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Michael, a lot of your work revolves around the question of what we want 21st century kids to know and understand. How do you answer that question?
Well, that's a great question. You know, you look at a whole changing landscape here, and what we really need to do, as Gavin was saying, is really look at critical creative thinking. We look at these 21st century skills. In addition to content area, we want to make sure that kids are critical thinkers, that they're able to be fair decision makers, that they're able to take information and construct deeper understanding, a much, much deeper conceptualization of what is going on than having this mile-wide coverage, which only goes an inch or so deep. So as an instructor, as a teacher, as a writer, what you want to do with kids is get them to be much better thinkers with the information that they're getting.
Brian, would you agree? I mean, what we've now heard from two people is that perhaps science education today is not so much about science facts and figures, but it's about critical thinking and understanding the information sources, the varied and multiple information sources available to us.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And as the earlier speaker said, I think we need people in our society today to be critical consumers of media. And that means to understand how to put a scientific argument together from evidence. What happens when the evidence needs to be put together over time and it's lots of little pieces of a puzzle? So rather than focusing just on the facts, the new science standards and the recommendations for classroom teaching emphasize getting at the deep explanatory ideas and at students' ability to put those ideas together and use them to explain things in the world.
Is that a really fundamental change from what we've been setting as our goals in science education in past decades?
It's really kind of an evolution of what the research has been saying since the 1960s. But we know a lot more now about how to put those ideas into standards and how to put those ideas into curriculum and into individual teachers' strategies in the classroom.
Michael, the idea of science standards goes back to the 1980s. What's some of the history there?
Oh, great question. You know, you'd like to think that it really came out with this brilliance of you want to make smarter kids, you want to have an incredible understanding of science. But what was driving it was a lack of students that were going to go into the workforce of engineering and technology. Also, generally poor performance on global tests, but we can talk about that at another time. So this really set up looking at a national concept of what science standards would be. So AAAS had worked on developing Project 2061, which looked at science literacy, which later evolved into the first version of science standards a decade and a half ago. And then about 3 years ago, we're looking at the frameworks for science, which came out, which really described what we call dimensions of science. So not only did you have this content, but you had incredible increased focus on other concepts, cross-cutting concepts. These are big ideas that occur through science. And also looking...
What would be an example of that?
Scale and structure. And you look at scale and structure being found in concepts that you're able to develop with students across the grade levels. Because an important part of standards is that you're following kids from young ages, from grade bands of K to 2 to 3 to 5 to 6 to 8. And you keep increasing these concepts in complexity. And you're making sure that the sophistication is appropriate for these students based upon what brain research says, based upon experience, based upon where we really want these children to go.
Brian, we're going to talk more specifically about the next generation science standards and other standards that are in place now. But I want to get your thoughts on where standards as a whole fit into the classroom and a child's learning experience. I mean, standards have become this kind of headline issue, a political issue. There are petitions about classroom standards at this point. But those shouldn't necessarily be the overarching, I don't know, the central focus of education. Where do standards fit into classroom practices? How does assessment fit in? How do all of these different things work together?
Right. I mean, standards are essentially our agreement as a nation, or our agreement, if they're state standards within the state, for what we feel is our obligation for every school child to learn. In a way, standards are saying this is the common bar that we want all kids to meet.
Well, and does that mean that it is that the bare minimum of what they need to know, or is this the aspirational goal that we're trying to meet? Where do standards fit?
Well, standards need to set out the bare minimum in the sense that, you know, individual kids will focus more on one discipline than the other, decide to pursue deeper learning in one path or another. So that's fine. But what we're saying is in order to participate as an informed citizen, not just trying to fill the pipeline, so to speak, of future scientists and engineers, but everyone is called upon to make decisions as an informed citizen that requires understanding scientific data, scientific arguments, and the applications of that science through engineering and technology.
Is there, in your mind, a right way and a wrong way to implement science standards?
The idea for standards is to guide the creation of curriculum materials, of the kinds of things that teachers do in the classroom. So standards are kind of setting out the broad mission. Then it's up to particular states or districts or schools and teachers to figure out how to achieve that mission. But what the standards say, for example, in the next generation science standards and in other standards that are now being developed, informed by the 2013 National Research Council framework, is we want kids to go beyond facts. Facts are important, but we want them to get to the deep explanatory ideas underneath, and we want them to understand how to and be able to participate in building and using scientific knowledge to explain the world around them.
So how do you build standards that do that? I mean, it would seem to be pretty easy to, you know, lay out a list of kids need to know A, B, and C. They need to know the size of the Earth and how many days it takes to, you know, orbit around the sun. But what do you put into the standards when you're trying to say, well, we want kids to be critical thinkers and be able to explain things?
Well, the framework that came out that informed the next generation science standards and other state standards that are coming out outlines as the multiple disciplines, multiple dimensions of science. So not just the ideas like how planetary bodies interact, but the science and engineering practices, things like making arguments, applying scientific ideas to explain particular things that are happening in the world, analyzing data, and so forth. And every standard that is articulated includes not only the scientific idea, but the practices that apply that idea to make sense of something going on in the world, and a connection, as the earlier speaker said, to the cross-cutting concept. Some big idea like structure and function, or stability and change, or how systems work.
What does that look like in the classroom? I mean, you and I were both at an education forum a few months ago where you kind of role-played a scenario in the classroom trying to meet some standards in the next generation science standards, where the teacher sounded a lot like a two-year-old, the constantly asking why, and a student would answer, and the teacher would say, yes, but why? Is that what you envision the new classroom sounding like?
Well, it's more like a clever parent of a two-year-old in a way, in that we want to ask why and push the kids to go deeper. And then as a teacher, we need to be able to figure out, okay, so we've just figured out we're actually confused and not sure whether it's explanation A or explanation B. So how are we going to go and get some evidence that will help us decide? And then coming up with some clever ideas about experiments we could do or data that we could look at in order to tease apart those possible explanations.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Brian Reiser and Michael DeSpezio about science standards and science education. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join our conversation. Michael, you've been nodding along as Brian is talking about what we should be trying to accomplish with standards and how to implement them in the classroom. And this is a lot of what you do, is figure out how to create textbooks and programs that would put standards into action. Do you think we're doing it right when it comes to implementing science standards in education in the United States?
Oh, great question. It really depends upon haves and have-nots, different groups of students that you're working with. I mean, there's quite a disparity in what certain students have and what other students do not. I mean, I'm doing a lot of work in the States, also internationally. So you're beginning to look at, what are my modalities of teaching? Is it video? Is it web? As Brian said and Gavin said, I mean, there's an incredible amount of information that's out there. I mean, student can get access to a library of information like that. Just go online. But what they do with the information is even more important. So what we've got to do is figure out a way that looks at what standards says, or the whole big concept of standards, and really celebrates that message and develop an effective way of bringing that to the students. Because you have to remember that science standards are not a curriculum. They're really expressed as far as content goes in what's called performance expectations, where instead of having a kid memorize, well, what are the parts of an atom? Well, we've got a nucleus here. We've got electrons, protons. You're not asking for that. You're asking for students, well, how would you develop a model of this? You're looking for a much deeper understanding. So, your question of are we effective? Are we not? It really depends upon what we're looking at, because all of this, essentially, I mean, tomorrow, look what's going on tomorrow, is the state is voting on the science standards
in Massachusetts.
They're voting on science standards, which will very much have a fair amount of the flavor of the next generation science standards in there, although Massachusetts has always been ahead of other states. I mean, we are incredible in what we're able to do. I mean, the teaching force is fantastic, but again, we are also in a state of haves and have-nots. What you're giving to some children with some opportunity to really develop these great thinking skills, understand content, understand how everything fits in, may not be the way that we're addressing other students. Other students may not have that experience.
Now, Brian, Michael just pointed out that in fact, Massachusetts is not adopting the next generation science standards that you have helped develop. What is the state of those new standards? Are they being adopted? Are they being rolled out? And how broadly are they being used at this point?
Right. So the standards came out in 2013. And as of today, 16 states plus the District of Columbia have adopted the Next Generation Science Standards, and that's approximately 35% of the children, of school children in the United States. But then, as Massachusetts is doing, some states and other and individual districts are looking at the recommendations of the framework for K-12 science education and making their own version of the standards that, that better fit their state, which, from the perspective of achieving the goals of the framework, is a wonderful thing and totally fine.
So you're not concerned that we don't have 100% adoption of next-gen science standards?
No, because it's better, actually, to have a slower rollout. These standards place really serious demands on today's teachers and today's schools, demands that we know teachers with proper support can meet, but we need time to develop the curriculum materials, for districts to have a professional learning plan for teachers. We need some time for districts and states to put those plans into place, and it doesn't do anyone any good to flip a switch and say, okay, tomorrow we're supposed to have full implementation of new science standards.
Michael, in terms of...
out over a couple of years.
Michael, in terms of what Massachusetts is implementing, you know, saying it's along the lines of the Next Gen Science Standards, same flavor, but a little bit different. What's maybe different? Why wouldn't Massachusetts just choose to adopt these standards that have been created at the national level for everybody?
Well, in the big picture, they are. I mean, you're looking at the dimensions of science. You're looking at 21st century learning skills that are coming in there, the higher level thinking. But when it gets down to the performance expectations, what Massachusetts has really done is maybe reworded, flip them around a little bit. So they're really mirroring what is coming out in frameworks, but then Massachusetts adds a few extra pieces that are
like,
in there.
Like what? At higher standards?
Yeah,
or?
No, no. At the same level, they might add another performance expectations that not only will students know how to process climate data and infer climate change, there might be another standard which then looks at, well, what about ocean temperature? How do we bring in ocean temperature and connect that to it? So it enriches it somewhat, but basically that whole concept of what we have with science standards, you know, is there. And to go along, another thing, what is driving it? We look at MCAS. I mean, everybody in Massachusetts knows MCAS, knows testing.
And now we're getting to know PARC as well. So let's talk about, for those who are perhaps not parents and in the thick of this, MCAS and PARC are the assessment side of things, not the standards, but these are the tests that students have to take in order to graduate. So how does that fit with the standards? Are they developed together and in coordination, or is this kind of a disjointed beast that we're seeing?
Great question, because what will happen is that assessment often drives what a teacher does. I mean, teachers have an incredible responsibility, and things are changing. You need to teach to the standards. You need to have your students performing this way. You need this, and there's not enough time in the day. Incredible what teachers are faced with. So now a teacher goes in, and they're getting these whole new standards to teach with, where, you know, NGSS states up front that we're not focused as much on content as we are in these other skills, the practices of being an engineer, the practices of science. What do we assess for? And speaking with friends that I had up in the State Department, they were talking about a slow changeover of MCAS over the next few years. They're going to be bringing in more and more concepts that reflect this next generation science standard, as opposed to the older set of standards that are in there.
Brian, you've helped create guidelines for assessments to go along with the next gen science standards. How do you envision effective assessment of things like critical thinking and being able to explain concepts? This doesn't sound like something that you can take a multiple choice test and be done with it.
Well, much as Michael was just saying, I mean, again, the key thing in the recommendations of the framework are combining the dimensions of the scientific ideas with the ability to use those ideas to make sense of the world, to explain or to make a model or to explain patterns in data. And so, the goal is not to assess critical thinking in general. It's to assess kids' ability to interpret an argument from evidence about climate data, or kids' ability to take the idea of all living things being made out of cells, and explain some interesting patterns in, say, blood glucose levels of a human during the day. So it's applying the ideas and going beyond just facts like what are the important parts of the cell to being able to answer questions like, but wait, like why do we have cells anyway? What do they do for us, and how does that work?
That's a tough question that I'm not sure I could answer. I mean, this is very different than what most of us now adults were taught in school. How do you address that? It often comes out, I think, as a concern from parents that this isn't what I was taught. You know, the jokes about the new math. How do you address those kinds of critiques and concerns about this shift?
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that needs to be part of an implementation plan for new standards is not only support for professionals such as teachers and administrators, but supports for our communities. We need to help parents learn about these new standards, learn a little bit about the motivation for them. I mean, it's really an equity issue of setting standards that everybody should be able to achieve, and learn about how they're based on decades of research, but also what are some strategies for helping your kid. And again, going beyond just is knowing the right facts, which, you know, a lot of us can't keep up with all the new science that's going on. But it's really pushing on helping your kid work through the reasoning. And in a way, that's a more achievable goal than knowing, you know, the names of the most recent elements that were identified or the most recent experiment in biotechnology.
Michael, working with schools all around the world, are teachers or parents equipped to deal with these new standards and this new focus of learning?
You know, it depends upon the parent. You look at something. I mean, I come from a generation that when I forgot something, I forgot it. That all of a sudden, maybe a week later, oh, yeah, that was it. Now you have instant access to that. You don't forget things anymore. If you do, you're right there on your cell phone or your tablet or your iPad, and you're getting the answer.
I've realized that I think with most things, I probably remember four key words that if I put them into Google will get me back to the information that I'm not bothering to remember at this point.
You know it. So what becomes very important is what you do with that information and how you work with it. We're looking at changes in science education where we're also looking at practical applications of what students are learning. We're looking at everyday examples. We are trying to personalize this because the data, the amount of content is easily accessible. However, again, it becomes more and more important what you're going to be doing with this data. Plus, we also have new directions and standards in looking at engineering. Although I might add, Massachusetts has been looking at engineering and technology for decades. But now that is at the forefront of science standards, that we're elevating engineering to the same level of scientific inquiry. So it is a whole other area, a whole other piece of curriculum, which we're putting on the plate of science teachers who are already overstressed with teaching all these things. And many of them have not had complete introduction to how do you teach engineering? What is engineering? Engineering is different from science. Do they know it? What will the students construct?
A lot of issues there that we will discuss more. That's Michael DeSpezio. Also with us, Brian Reiser of Northwestern University. I'm Heather Goldstone. Our toll-free phone number here at Living Lab is 866-999-4626. We'll talk more about science education, standards, and reform when Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking science education with Brian Reiser, professor of learning sciences at Northwestern University, and Michael DeSpezio. He's author, TV host, and speaker specializing in science and science education. Michael, before the break, you were talking about the ready availability of factual information that we can get on a computer and look up any fact that we may have forgotten, that perhaps it's not as important these days to try to remember those facts. But pushing back against that, there are also plenty of people who say we are allowing ourselves to just become stupid, that we're not holding ourselves to any standards, that we need to have those facts in our head in order to be able to do the kind of reasoning that we've been talking about. So where's the balance there? How many facts do we need to know, and how much can we rely on technology?
Well, the world is certainly changing, and we do need to know facts. But as I said, what becomes even more important is what do we do with these facts? because we've got instant access. We've got instant access to the libraries of the world through the internet. So it becomes critical then to develop your whole arsenal, your whole set of critical thinking analysis skills, so you're able to evaluate, understand, critique the information that you're getting. And then once you have that, then you're looking at another set of practices in science and engineering. What do you do with this? How do you apply this? How do you improve the human condition? I mean, my whole passion in science and education is, how do you make the world fair based to everyone? How do you improve the human condition all around? And I see education as that great leveler. And you can do it, but you need to make sure that those skills are developed in students. Let me give you a good example with parents. And we can do a whole bunch of, you know, hints for parents, parents 101, things for you to do. One of them is wait time. Ask a student a question. As Brian was saying, questioning is incredibly important because you don't want to give a student the answer, but you also want to give them enough time that they can think about it. The old thing on wait time was a teacher would pose a question, and within several seconds, the teacher would answer it or have a student answer it. You don't do that. You pose a question to your child or to a student, and you wait.
So my mother-in-law is a retired science teacher, and I believe she was in Iceland and went to observe a school. And she said the most amazing thing she saw was the teacher sat down with a class of about 20 kids, and they spent 45 minutes on one question. Because what she did is she went through each, the teacher went to each student, asked them the same question, and gave them as much time as they needed to answer the question, and left complete silence for as long as necessary for that child to formulate an answer. And she said that's something that would be completely unheard of in any American school.
Yes and no, because remember, we are under the gun with standards that you have to cover a certain amount of material. Ideally, you want to give a child, especially in your home, again, looking back at parents, let them develop those skills. I mean, my son Anthony was great. Anthony, growing up, Susan and I would have him, you know, ask questions and stuff like that. And he came back and he asked a question of me. Dad, how come you never answered my question or always answered my question with a question? And my reply
He's
was,
paying attention.
Well, right. My reply was, well, what do you think? No, but it's critical to get students so that they're not doing the immediate recall, but they're going deeper into their learning, deeper into the connectivity, their connections, their learning schema in their brain, so that they're able to compose an answer which is deeper in understanding.
Brian, part of focusing on thinking and reasoning, giving kids time to ask and answer questions, is also the possibility of failure and the confidence to fail. And that's something that I think has come to the forefront in the past couple of years, that perhaps we're not allowing our students to fail enough. Is that something that is maybe built into the next gen science standards in some way? Or is there a way to build that into standards? Is that something that has to be addressed in another way?
I think it's a really interesting issue. And I think rather than making a sort of dichotomy between success or and failure, we have to keep in mind that that's actually not the way that science works. Science works, as does engineering, by incrementally building ideas, or in the case of engineering, solutions to problems, incrementally building them over time. So it's not that a particular science idea is either correct or incorrect. It's typically a model or a theory is effective at explaining certain things, but has limitations, some things that it can't explain. We didn't throw away, for example, Newton's laws when Einstein came up with his innovative theories. He expanded everything we already knew in physics. Some things were tweaked, some things were changed, but much of what we already knew was correct. It was just incomplete. So that is the kind of experience we want students to have. It's not that they need to fail, quote unquote. It's that the model that we're building, let's say, this week, might be effective in some ways and have some gaps. And in another week, we're going to take that model and expand it and explain more than we were able to do before. We might have to change some pieces. So it's not that we were wrong. We're just not as right as we're going to be in the future.
That's Brian Reiser of Northwestern University. If you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Glenn is on the line from Falmouth. Glenn, what's on your mind?
Yes, just quickly, I want to say I'm very fortunate on two counts. I went to Northwestern, and I've known Michael for many years, and he's an incredible educator.
Thank you, Glenn.
Talker on the science subjects. My question is, 2016, of course, is upon us. It's a very critical election year at the local, state, national levels, and global warming is a hot or cold topic, cold to many candidates who just seem to have a certain stated position on it. I wondered, what would you suggest in terms of sorting out the best candidates to support on global warming or science issues, and also what might you suggest doing at the local level?
All right. Thanks for those questions, Glenn. Michael, do you want to tackle that one? Any suggestions on if climate change and education are issues, are there candidates that seem stronger in those realms?
Well, you know, yes and no. You're looking at a concept of what the candidates are backing as far as both educational reform and also in the concepts of global climate
and those
change.
Two may not line up.
Exactly. Those that are backing the science standards, and the science standards are full of concepts in climate change, looking at how the climate in the Earth is dynamic. It is not static. Things are changing. We've got data supporting all this change. We've got warm-up that's occurring. So any of the candidates that are really backing the changes or looking towards these new science standards are really supporting these concepts of looking at a global awareness to the changing world. Separately, you've got to look really at the political structure, and I am not by any means an expert in that, on what everybody is backing and how far. I think right now, most of the candidates are agreeing that things are changing. How much of it is human influenced? How much is part of a natural cycle? That you're going to have to tease out, or they're going to have to tease that out.
A lot of questions. Maybe this is one of those where the answer is simply that we need to apply our critical thinking skills and go do some research on our own. Paul is giving us a call from Dennis. Paul, you're on the air.
Good morning. On the subject of critical thinking, there are an enormous number of teachers out there right now that I believe do never had a course in critical thinking. And I'm wondering if there's a mandatory thing for teachers to have a course in critical thinking, and at what age should you start having courses in critical thinking for children?
I think those are great questions, Paul. Let's see if Brian has an answer for that. I mean, both in terms of what is the professional development for teachers to support them moving into this new way of learning, and then is there ever too early an age to start learning in this way, really focusing on reasoning and critical thinking?
Right. So I think, let me take the children question first. I think rather than thinking of it as a course in critical thinking per se, what we know from the research is that the ability to tease apart an argument or to put together an explanation from individual data pieces, it's something that is best learned within each discipline. So it's not a course in critical thinking. It's pushing kids to think deeply when they're learning science or when they're learning math. Or when they're learning history. And absolutely, there is no time that is too early to start. One of the things that is important for the coherence of the new science standards and what's recommended in the framework is it's the same science and engineering practices for kindergartners as it is for 12th graders. We just get more sophisticated over time, but those same practices of making an argument from data, building a model that explains patterns of observations. We're having kindergarten kids do that as well as 12th grade kids.
Well, and as a parent of three young children, it seems to me that in a lot of ways what these new standards are focusing on is something that kids do naturally as soon as they can, well, talk. Certainly they start asking these questions, right? But that's the thing that kids do is they walk around the world exploring and saying, what is that? How does it work? And why? And maybe this is just formalizing that.
Absolutely. And what we know from the last several decades of research
in developmental psychology and in other disciplines is that even in the crib, kids are testing hypotheses. Even before they have language, they're learning associations, they're teasing apart cause and effect relationships.
So, and one part of this is that there's become an increased focus in schools on what's called project-based learning. Basically, that kids are not just sitting there reading a book, but they're doing something to learn this. And Michael, you've been over here wanting to jump up and down, jump in about project-based learning. This is kind of where the science has been leading us. How much is this being implemented in schools?
It is quite a bit, especially those schools that are pursuing STEM initiatives. You may be familiar with STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, looking at really blending these in to get an effective landscape for teaching these subjects, not individually, but as an integrated approach. And part of that integrated approach looks at PBL, project-based learning. In project-based learning, what we do is put students in together in small teams where they're able to select, develop the project, and will spend weeks, months sometimes, on really addressing the project and then communicating their results. Very different from when you and I went to school where you were given a list of things to learn. All right, everybody, tomorrow you're going to learn A, B, C, D, E, F. Make sure you memorize it. So you'd come back, you'd have the test. Okay, I can spit back A, B, C, D, E, F right here. And then all of a sudden, whoosh, you flush it away. The whole concept of project-based learning is that you put students in a scenario where they're able to act, behave, to learn the processes, to learn the concept of what it would be like to function in the real world. Because in the real world, look at us, we're working with a team here. You're here, Dan's outside there. I mean, you're looking at a number of people working together towards a common goal. And that's the whole concept with shaping the classroom experience around project-based learning. And I might add one other thing. You were talking about questioning and checking out the environment. That's all part of another major concept, which we didn't address, and that's inquiry. And inquiry is a basic part of the human condition. We're always trying to find out more about the world around us. And we can shape that into a number of educational strategies in science.
We could probably talk about this topic for 3 hours, but we only have about 30 seconds left. Brian, do you think we are moving in a good direction in terms of science education in this country?
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that we're trying to do is to move beyond false dichotomies like learning facts versus learning deep understanding. What we know is the facts need to be built on a strong foundation, and you build this foundation of explanatory ideas, as Michael is saying, not by just learning them, but by learning them in the context of trying to make sense or solve problems in the world around us.
That is Brian Reiser. He's professor of learning sciences in the School of Education and Social Policy at Northwestern University. Also here in the studio with me is Michael DeSpezio. He's an author, TV host, and speaker specializing in science and science education. Thank you so much to both of you for a fabulous discussion this morning.
You are welcome.
Thank you.
We did not get to all of the phone calls. If you were on the line and we didn't get to hear from you, please go to our website, capeandislands.org, and leave a comment. Get in touch that way. We'd still love to hear from you and continue the conversation. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Elsa Partan and Heather Goldstone. Jenny Junker answers the phones. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and by the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation.